one of the other directors joined in and said, you know, Maury Howell is right. I mean, after all, if there's any job that we have that's important, selecting the CEO. And Peter Storbridge, that was, Jack Miller also. And so Maury said, well, he's standing outside ready to come in after the vote. I said, well, why don't you do yourself and us a favor and go to the door and tell him to go away. And then let's approach this the way we should. So he did, and subsequently we had a considerable dialogue at the board level, individually and together, and we decided to make Larson president for 18 months so we could get a look at him, the chief operating officer, before he was named CEO. But I'm saying no more important job than that. The second example is an example, and I'll actually give you three. The second example is an example where Larson had been meeting with the Bank of Boston about merging the two institutions. And we called this together on a Thursday night, I remember. And Morgan Stanley or J.P. Morgan, one of those people, New York law firm there, to advise the board about the proposed merger of the Bank of Boston and Core States. Larson says, I'm going to be CEO of the surviving bank. The headquarters is going to be in Boston. It's a fairness opinion. What a good thing, that says. I have a problem. What's the problem? I said, well, there are only two things to decide, the merger of equals, and that's who's the CEO is and where the headquarters is, and you've decided them both. But I'm telling you, this is a 175-year-old bank, the oldest bank, I guess First Pennsylvania was, but we've inherited that heritage, huh? And I don't give a damn who the CEO is, but I want the headquarters here. Everybody woke up, and we discussed that for a little bit, and he said, well, he said, I need unanimous approval to proceed. And I said, you don't have it. And I said, first of all, there are several things wrong with this process. We had a discussion at the board about mergers and acquisitions, and you never mentioned this. I said, that's one. Number two, I have no interest in consultants that you hire advising this board. These consultants should be advisors to the board, not to the manager. Don't believe a thing they said. This bank was in great trouble, the Bank of Boston, just 3 years ago. And now we're being told it's in wonderful shape. I said, if that's true, Terry, their CEO should be CEO, because you haven't straightened out the acquisition of First Pennsylvania yet. So this doesn't hang together for me. And we're not talking about a merger or the acquisition of some jerkwood of bank in Bucks County. We're talking about putting this bank out of business in Philadelphia. Now, you can tell me that Rosemary Greco is going to be the president of the Philadelphia region, but that's not like having a headquarters here. Well, one or two other directors joined in. Gannon came back and said, well, I'd like unanimous approval to proceed. And I said, well, I'll tell you again, you may go forward with all but one vote, but you're not getting my vote. And I said, and the reason for that is you can't come in here and just run over this board because you think, as CEO, you can do that. And one of that, again, Peter Storger said, count my vote with Hal's, Jack Miller said, count my vote for the House. I said, well, what are we going to do? Well, the compromise was that we let him go, do the due diligence, and said we reconvene after our people had gone in and done the due diligence. They went in and did the due diligence and called us and canceled the next meeting because they found the bank wasn't in very good shape. So much for J.P. Morgan, or whoever it was, Morgan Stanley. So those are kinds of things that are interesting. And the other part that was, you asked me what role do I play, and I've always been interested in either whether it's a board of a corporation or a board of a cultural organization or any kind of an organization, in making those organizations open to people of all types and so forth. And there's just another little instance that I'll tell you on. It was the Department Mutual board meeting. We were appointing a new CEO. And one of the existing executives was being considered. One of the women board members said, you know, she said, he's not like us. And I don't really think he ought to be chairman. And I asked her what not like us meant. And she said, well, I think you know what I mean. And I said, no, I don't know what I mean. I said, she said, well, I think it's clear. And I said, no. I said, you mean he's not a 38-long wide-angle Saxon Protestant? And I said, and if he was the candidate, we probably wouldn't have to listen to you say this because you wouldn't be on this board. When that was the criteria, we didn't have women on boards. So now, why don't we talk about what he's done? Has he done a brilliant job in marketing? Has he increased the profitability of the company? Can he run the company? But I'm not interested in hearing he's not people like us. Because I don't know what that means. Neither am I. So, you know, and I think if there's anything I've done over the years, and it's caused great consternation to some people, it was to make the selection of people, both as executives and as board members, an open process where you select people on the basis of their ability and their accomplishments, not their backgrounds. And so, you know, service on a board is interesting, challenging. You're not there simply to support the management, supposedly. You're there representing the shareholders. You get paid for it. And there's a lot of work, which a lot of people don't understand, if you do it faithfully. You know, particularly banks. Bank boards, the amount of material and the standard of knowledge that the Federal Deposit Insurance Company sets are very at very high level. And so if you're going to be on one of those boards, you have to be expected to work and participate and recognize what your responsibility is. As we go through now, Provident Mutual, we're tied up in court now, on Mutual Holding Company, which is a mutual company going to a mutual holding company, eventually going public, kind of thing. And, you know, what's the board's responsibility? And I've said and argued my responsibility is the policy holders. That's what a mutual company is. And one director I remember said, who's a lawyer, said, your responsibility is to the company. And I said, well, I disagree with that. And for me to vote for whatever we're doing, I have to be sure that the policy holder is adequately represented and it gets his fair share of whatever happens. And sure enough, that's what the lawsuit is about. So, you know, I'm saying all of those are important things. And the nice thing about being on commercial boards is, for the most part, you're working with people of substance who are bright, intelligent, capable, and that results in itself in interesting dialogue and a lot of interplay. So.
Just going from there, Hal, across a little bit to the more civic area, you've been on a number of non-profit boards, the Academy, the Orchestra. What's the similarities and the differences?
Yeah, well, I mentioned part of this before. It's very interesting because I've been around long enough in Philadelphia, originally from the 50s, late 50s and 60s, 70s, 80s. Philadelphia was a reasonably closed community from the standpoint of there were certain boards and certain things that where the qualifications really were more background than anything else. As a result of that, they were difficult to get on and so forth. And I had the good fortune of one being in charge of a large corporation, which gave away a fair amount of money, and obviously people wanted to you to be involved because they thought it was beneficial from the standpoint of support. And two, being associated with a Vanguard corporation like Atlantic Richfield, it was very progressive and had outstanding support of charitable and cultural organizations and leadership that really was very well respected in that regard in Bob Anderson and Glenn Bradshaw. So I mention that because I became associated with the Pennsylvania Academy through a friendship on a National Historic Development Corporation between Bob Anderson and Henry McNeil. Bob Anderson, the chairman of ARCO, was very interested in historic preservation, and he was on the board of the National Historic Preservation Corporation. So was Henry McNeil, and Bob said to Henry one day, "I want you to meet our man in Philadelphia, Hal Sorgenti. He's interested in historic preservation as well, and has restored some houses in Philadelphia, and I think you would enjoy meeting him, Henry." So I got a call from Henry McNeil's office, and we had lunch at the Philadelphia Club, which I'd never been in before, and we had a nice time. And I remember there was a man called Charles Woodward, who is very, very interesting. People, the Woodward family owns, you know, half of Chestnut Hill, and of course the Woodmere Art Museum and so forth. And they've been very active recently in supporting, for instance, this time Mrs. Woodward, I think, put a fair amount of money in Happy Fernandez campaign. Before that, Peter Herner and so forth. So Woodward was there, I was there, and I forget who else was there. We talked about historic preservation and the fact that I was engaged in some historic renovations. Henry asked me, said he was chairing the board at the Pennsylvania Academy, and you know, it was a beautiful old historic building, and he thought I might find it interesting to join that board. And so I did join that board. And so the connection was Anderson and McNeil to me in what was a very, very prestigious old guard board. Lenore Annenberg was on the board, and Bonnie Winterstein was on the board, and a number of very prestigious people in Philadelphia. And as a matter of fact, at the end of the year when there was a deficit, McNeil would stand up and he'd say, "Well, we're short $250,000. I'll take $150,000, Bonnie." And I'd sit there quivering, hoping it never got to me, that Bonnie and Lenore and Henry would take it all, because we couldn't afford to give them any kind of money. So it was very interesting, and I worked with them, and was on the board for a number of years, met a lot of very influential people through that association, came to have great love for American portraits, and I was collecting them at the time that I went there, and that was one of the things that Henry McNeil liked. And since I started to collect African American art, and because there are a lot of African American painters and professors at the school. But anyway, make a long story short, Henry chairmanship turned to Pete Mather, and we had to select a new director, and Henry McNeil died, but not before we had a school building in the old Belgravia Hotel at Chestnut Street had been given to us, and we had a report that there were many violations from a fire standpoint and so forth. And so the board became quite concerned that if anything happened and a student was hurt, the board would be liable, and so we had decided we had to move. Henry walked out of the building after the board meeting, and we used to have our board meetings in the Peel Club, which was a wonderful private club that you could join for practically nothing associated with the Pennsylvania Academy. I discontinued it when I became chairman, but maybe that was a mistake. But anyway, walked across the street, saw the Oliver Bear Funeral Home, liked it, bought it for $1 million, donated it to us, and then turned over the chairmanship to Peter Mather. And Peter, they did a study, and the building wasn't really appropriate. And so Pete stood up at the next board meeting and said that we had a problem. This building was a lovely building, but it wasn't appropriate. Didn't know whether we should move the school there or not. And I always remember this. Henry stood up and said, "Do I understand that you are not happy with the gift that I made?" Pete said, "Well," tried to explain. Henry said, "Fine. I will repurchase the building from the Academy for $1.5 million. Resign from this board, and you will never see another cent from the McNeil family as long as I live. Now I'd like you to take the vote as to whether you want to move to the new building or not in that context." And he sat down. Well, there was a lot of stammering, and these are what I call the great moments of participation on boards. There was a lot of stammering, and we moved to the building. The second thing that Pete Mather had to do was to select a new head of the institution. And they ran a search and so forth, and Peter Solmson was the, as a matter of fact, Sam Hamilton, who was on the board, married to Dodo Hamilton, who was the Campbell suit bearers, head of the search committee, and they recommended Peter Solmson, who is now at the University of the Arts, has done a wonderful job there. But at the board meeting, it was very interesting. Pete Mather said, "We have the recommendation of the search committee, but I would like to propose another candidate, which your executive committee endorses." That's Frank Goodyear. I raised my hand and I said, "Was not the search committee a committee appointed by the board?" He said, "Yes, it was." And I said, "Well, the executive committee overruled the recommendation of the search committee? I don't quite understand. Do you think you've adequately explained the reason for that?" "Well, we just think that Mr. Goodyear is a better candidate. We voted. I abstained. He was confirmed." afterwards, I went up to Bonnie Weinstein, who was a, she was Henry McElhenney's sister and a great art collector. She once complained to me that she had to sell her Picassos because she had to hire someone to sit with them when she went out. And after all, it got to be too expensive and too much trouble, and so she was selling. So, make a long story short, I said, Bonnie, what's going on? Oh, she said, we wanted Frank Goodyear. And I said, well, who's wanted Frank Goodyear? She said, Lenore and I and Lois McNeil. And so we went to Pete and we said, it's either, if you choose Frank Goodyear, we'll give you $1 million. And if you don't choose Frank Goodyear, we'll resign from the board. And he said, so we have Frank Goodyear, don't we? She had a big smile on her face. And I said, well, Bonnie, she said, I said, if that was me, I would have told you to go to hell. She said, that's why we're going to make you chairman in a short while. So Pete was chairman, and Sam was vice chairman, and Sam became chairman, and I became vice chairman, and I just as Bonnie wanted it, and then was chairman for 7 or 8 years. We faced a great deal of difficulty because the move to the school was a mistake to the Oliver Bear building, and we lost a tremendous amount of our registration. And we were faced with the problem of rebuilding a new school building and facilities. But a lot of people didn't realize that one of the attractions of the academy is individual studios space for the students. And we couldn't do that at the Bear building. So to make a long story short, it took years and another change in management and really quite interesting and wonderful exposure to a lot of Philadelphia society. And we had a tough time at the Academy trying to make ends meet, and frankly had a change management again. Frank Goodyear, and they're still struggling. So that was kind of how I got involved at the Academy. The other interesting thing is just within the last few weeks, I just resigned after 20 years on the board, and they had a little party the other night to welcome the new provost and to recognize Chuck Andes and I. Chuck replaced me as chairman. Don Caldwell was chairman now. And we announced that Ann and I had donated to the Academy 95 works of art by African American artists, which I had purchased from. We hadn't donated, we put it on loan. Which I had purchased from the Arco Chemical Company. While I was at Arco Chemical Company, one of the thrusts of our investment in art and so forth was to build a substantial collection of African American, contemporary African American artists. I had asked them to donate it to the Academy, and they refused. Said that if their first choice was to sell it, their second choice, if they wanted to donate it, would be in Houston. And so I've purchased the collection and have it on loan to the Pennsylvania Academy, and because I think it's a severely neglected area in their collection. So it's kind of interesting, and so even though I'm not on the board, I continue to be involved, and the collection is going to be known as the Harold A. and Ann Sargenti Collection of Contemporary African American Art. We have a substantial collection of our own, some of which is in this office. That we're sitting in, and at some time we'll donate that as well, or work it into the collection that's there. It's my intention over the long term, if they handle it properly, to donate the collection to the museum. So that was the involvement there. And then the other area I got involved in, which is interesting, was the University of the Arts. And that was one of the first things I got involved in. And that was because we had donated a number of things as a company to the University of the Arts. You may remember on Delancey Street and Broad, we built a park with some ceramic murals in them by an artist called Herbert Beyer, who was very closely associated with Bob Anderson and the Aspen Institute and so forth. And then we had donated our building at the corner of 260 South Broad Street that Broad and Spruce to the University of the Arts. So I was involved with that. And another one of those classic stories that I like to tell occurred when they named the building at 260 South Broad Street Anderson Hall, in honor of our chairman, Bob Anderson. And we had a dinner that night at the Keith Physic House, which is close to you, which, by the way, is a wonderful building that has to hold a small dinner party with 32 people. And it has, which you may not know, Philadelphia windows. I don't know if you know what those are, but the windows go floor to ceiling, and they roll up into the ceiling so that each of the windows becomes a doorway out to a terrace. And so you have cocktails on the terrace, and then you come inside to the dining room and so forth. It's actually quite a lovely thing. I've only seen one other house that had those kinds of windows, and that was in Ardmore, which was quite interesting. They call it Philadelphia. Anyway, we're having this dinner, 32 people. We're sitting at a table on Bob Anderson's table, and there's a woman there. Her name was Lolly Lloyd. It was one of the old Philadelphia families. And the Lloyds had a big estate out in on Darby Peoli Road, and she was a very significant art collector, and she was a good friend of Bob Anderson's. But she looked around, and she saw a black man who was Walter Livingston, who was an architect. I think it was Walter, it was Maurice Clifford. Maurice Clifford, I think, was the head of the Pennsylvania Medical College, either one of them, I forget. And she said loudly at the table, she was quite old, "Good God," she said, "first they forced us to accept the Italians and Jews, but now we have to have dinner with a black man." Good God. So Bob said, "Lolly, have you met Mr. Sorgenti, who is the head of our company in Philadelphia?" "Sorgenti?" She said, "Oh, yes, I've met him." He said, "Oh, you know Mr. Sorgenti," trying to tell her he's Italian, you know, and you're talking about having to accept the Italians and Jews. Well, a large part of that was true. And so I've never had any illusions about being involved in these things. I mean, I got involved in the Pennsylvania Academy through the good graces of Bob with his Henry McNeil. He was, you know, he knew everybody and all over the world. And I mean, he was a fantastic man. He was head of the Eisenhower Exchange Fellowship here in Philadelphia. And so he had contacts all over the world. When you traveled with him, he knew executives and people who ran ministries and whatnot from the Eisenhower Exchange Fellowship Program, which was here in Philadelphia. So very well connected. And obviously, when you were with ARCO, and ARCO was a very generous company, you got appointed to some of these boards. And the University of the Arts, we had given so much to them, they always wanted somebody from ARCO on the board. What I've always tried to do is to do the things that nobody else wants to do, and to do some of the difficult things. And then secondly, to make the boards open to anybody. If you look at the Pennsylvania Academy, when I went on it 20 years ago, it wasn't a very open board. It was a very closed board. Today, if anything, it's very open. There are lots of Jewish people, lots of other people, and maybe they haven't spent as much time cultivating or reinvigorating its fundamental base, which was a narrow society, people with background and so forth, and traditions that go back to the founding of the oldest museum in America. But I was part of that process of opening up that board. We brought a number of Jewish collectors on the board and so forth, and basically changed the criteria for what do you consider for a board member. Well, we want people who are interested in art or education or the collection of art, and we really don't ask a lot more than that. I'm not interested in what religion they are or what their father did. There's a classic example of we were selecting a new president, and one of the board members, first of all, let's talk about selecting a new director. Who was nomination was the man who used to own Hess Department Stores, and Philip Berman, and subsequently became chairman of the Museum of Art, the big museum as we call it. And one of our board members said, she said, you know, his father worked as a chauffeur for my father. I said, well, that's very interesting. And I said, I didn't know that. But we haven't nominated his father. We've nominated him. So we were choosing, to get back to the other story, we were choosing the president, and there were three candidates, and one woman said, who is Jewish? Well, you know, he's a Jew. I said, wait a minute, wait a minute. I said, no, I didn't know that, but I am not interested in having this conversation. She said, well, you should have it. It's very important. He won't be able to function effectively. He won't be able to fundraise effectively. And I think that's an important consideration. I said, this is out of line, and I am not interested in this conversation. And you step over the line, and you're in very dangerous territory as far as I'm concerned. If this individual were not selected and were to know of this conversation, we would have a serious problem. It's not a consideration, and I want you all to ignore that. Well, fortunately, he withdrew. So I'm saying, you know, a lot of this still exists, and I'm saying I don't live under any illusions, and there are other instances I could tell you. And, I had had loaned $1 million to WHYY because of the presence and the power of Jim Carrigan, who was the leader, and the board fired him. So I wrote a letter to WHYY saying that I wanted the board to clearly understand that this was a loan, not a gift, and that the Carrigan made a commitment to pay it back, and so forth. In the course of the discussion of my letter, one of the directors, who was an old guard, stood up and said, I'm not going to let some loudmouthed wop from South Philadelphia tell me what to do. It's kind of interesting because I'm not from South Philadelphia, but nonetheless, you know, and so you see a lot of that, and you know, it's unfortunate. It's still around. I can tell you one or two other instances, which are great instances. We named three Jewish people to the board of the orchestra. I was on the nominating committee, and I was stopped on Broad Street by a woman who had been associated with the orchestra for generations, and she said to me, I am disappointed and discouraged when I hear that you've nominated such trash to our board. She used the word trash. And I said to her, well, madam, I said, the board is interested in building a new concert hall, and we certainly know you're not going to give enough money to do it. And these people have the means and the wherewithal to help us move to the next level. And I walked on, but I never quite got over that. And because these were people of substance that we had nominated, but in her view, had no meaning to be on the board. And then the final instance I'll just tell you is sitting on the Core States board, which is quite interesting. If you deliver $10,000 of cash to a bank, it's a reportable event to the federal government. And banks were being fined for not reporting these in a discussion with the board. One of the directors raised his hand and said, I think we ought to have an outside order to come in, and they ought to begin in South Philadelphia immediately. Raised my hand. Excuse me, but I don't understand why you want to begin in South Philadelphia. I said, I think we all know why we want to begin in South Philadelphia. I said, I don't know why he would consider South Philadelphia any more than Center City or the Northeast. I think everybody knows. I said, well, I just finished telling you. I don't know. So educate me. Tell me why you think you ought to begin in South Philadelphia. Maury Darn said, I really don't think this is a discussion that the board has to have. The management will retain the consultant and we'll decide where to go. But we all know why he wanted to begin in South Philadelphia. So, you know, I'm saying Philadelphia is a city where there is a lingering undercurrent, and little by little it is being broken down. And I've tried to be involved and help that process. The last thing I'll mention is when the U.S. Open was going to be held at the Aeronautic Country Club, they came to me. I was still at ARCO. And they asked if they could park 10,000 cars on our 300 acres of property. We were in close proximity to Aeronautic. And I said to them, why would I do that? They said, well, it would be the neighborly thing to do. I want to remember this. And I said, oh, neighborly. I said, I understand what neighborly means. I said, you're very close to us. And I said, it would be nice if we had a member at Aeronautic who was on our management staff. I said, you know, but I understand you don't take Italians. He just turned down my good friend Roy Pareto. They said, well, that's absolutely not true. I said, well, then good. I said, I'd like to be a member. They said, well, we had a 7-year waiting list. I said, well, wait 7 years to park your cars. I want to be a member. You want to park your cars? I'm a member. You park the cars. Well, I mean, we can't do that. Doesn't mean anything to me. I don't want your cars on my lawn. The next day I get a phone call. I can make an exception. I can be a social member. I said, well, I've done a lot of thinking about it, and you can have your choice of either or two Jews or a black man as a member. They're all on my staff. I said, I'm afraid that would be impossible. I said, well, park your car someplace else. Now, you remember that the U.S. Open told them they wouldn't hold it there unless they had one black member, and they refused. So, you know, very, very interesting, but So my involvement when I get on the board has always been to try and bring it into the 20th century from the standpoint of being open and looking at people and what they contribute, not what their background. I started this by saying I always looked at the difficult things, and I was thinking the other day about if you asked me the question, which I'm sure you might have anyway, but is what are the things that I've done in the civic area that I'm the proudest of? And I guess there are so many, three or four stand out. One is the restructuring of the Chamber of Commerce and bringing in new people there. Thatcher Longstreth had been there for 27 years, and in my view, if the Chamber was to move forward and the city was to move forward and so forth, we needed a new breed of leadership. He was very well connected with certain members of the board. But when I took over as chairman, I convinced the board that it was time to move on.
When was that?
I forget. But I go back.
In the 80s?
Early 80s. And it was after he made the comment that the only way to improve the economy in Philadelphia was to move the city to Houston. And followed that by being in a bed-making contest at the hotel on City Line Avenue that was there. And, you know, I said, well, we're never going to make any progress. You cannot improve something unless you believe in it. And so the board told me they would go along with bringing in somebody to replace Thatcher. And I had lunch with Thatcher and told him that I wanted him to resign. And he said, well, how much are you going to pay me? And I said, well, you're making $60,000 a year. I'll pay you 6 months' salary. He said, they tried to force the guy out in San Francisco. He got $1 million. I said, well, Thatcher, I don't want to be a skin flint. We'll make it a year's salary, $60,000. I'm not doing it. I said, well, we can do this as gentlemen. Thatcher, I'd love to do that. And, you know, I'd like your handshake and your agreement to cooperate and to help the new man. Or we can do it as opponents. He said, I'm leaving here and I'm going to the board. He said, they'll never support you. I said, Thatcher, you don't think I'm dumb enough to come in here without having the votes, do you? Listen to me. Let's do this as friends. He said, well, you realize that I don't have any retirement. I've been funding all of the losses for the chamber from my retirement fund. I said, no, I don't realize that. God, Thatcher, that's one of the stupidest things I've ever heard. Why would you do that? He said, because we couldn't raise the money. And I said, good God. I said, well, I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I said, I don't know how much money is involved. He said, well, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. I said, well, I said, I'll make you whole. I'll promise you that. And I said, whatever it is, I'll make you whole so that you'll have a retirement and an annuity, which you can have in perpetuity. So the way we did that was he became a recipient of the William Penn Award, and we told the various companies, the leadership, what we were trying to do, and we doubled or tripled the price of tables, and the excess money was put into Thatcher's retirement fund. And so he left happy from that standpoint, with very cooperative help young Fred DeVona come in and improve things. And of course, they were stuck at a couple of thousand members. I don't know how many they got today, but Fred increased it to 4, and Nick increased it to 6, and I don't know how many they've got. So that young, new talent came in, and we moved to new offices, and the chamber is a vital progressive institution. So the restructuring of the chamber was one, and we're putting new leadership in there. The other thing we did was we formed Philadelphia First Corporation, which continues today, which was to bring together the top 10 or 12 CEOs to work in concert on problems and bringing the power to bear and the financial muscle to bear that those top 12 or 13 corporations had to help solve problems, whether they be fundraising, community problems, education, and whatnot. So that was another. And the third was the formation of something called the Local Initiative Support Corporation, LISC, still exists. Ford Foundation came to us and said, we'll put $1 million into this Local Initiative Support Corporation if you'll match it. And I'll always remember this. Dick Duran and I walked down Market Street, stopping at ARA, Cigna, and Roman Haas, and so forth, and raised $1 million in a day to match it, putting $2 million into the Local Initiative Support Corporation, which funds the missing equity piece.